Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining me. My name is Sam, and I am your host for the In Her Own Words podcast. This podcast is a project that came out of the Black Woman and Political Leadership class taught at Cornell University by the amazing Professor Carol Boyce Davies. But this podcast has a bit of a twist. For the next 45 minutes, you have been welcomed to the all-new, one-night-only, wonderful Wari Woman Jazz Cafe. We'll be playing some beautiful music and chatting with an incredible woman, Miss Irene Smalls, the author of 15 children's books, the founder of Wanawakewa Wari House, the Black Alumni Association, and her newest initiative, Literacize. It was such a joy getting to interview her, and she has an inspiring story to share. So, sit back, relax, make yourself a cup of tea, and enjoy the show.
Okay, so I'll start with the first question, then also just kind of giving you some background about our speaker today, Miss Irene Smalls, who is the founder of Wari House, that I currently live in. So a lot of us in the house and also at Cornell University currently know you as the founder of our house in 1968. Could you tell us the story of what led you to your founding of Wari House?
Well, there's a lot of things going on in 1968, as you can imagine. And part of the issue was that they were trying to expel. There was an incident where Black women were in a dorm room at Balch straightening their hair. And as you know from hair straightening, it has a particular odor. And the white girls in the dorm called the police and said the Black girls were doing drugs. And the idea that they could not conceive of, could have been doing a science experiment. We could have been doing elaborate facials. We could have been doing a lot of things. But the one thing that they assumed that Black women would be doing behind closed doors is doing drugs. And so that was one precipitating incident. And then there was another incident where they were trying to expel a Black student, saying that she didn't have the proper social skills, et cetera. She was academically superior, able to do the work, but she couldn't fit in at Cornell. And I remember I had gone to see her in the hospital because they had hospitalized her. And she said to me, "White girls have soft pee." And I was like, "What did you say?" I mean, that just freaked me out. But what that said to me was that this Black girl had been so beaten down that she was comparing her biological functions to the functions of white women. And the fact that she could not see herself as being a whole human being with as much right to have her bodily functions at whatever volume they are, really said to me, they've almost broken her. And so I felt that in light of, you know, these kinds of things, and it was the 60s, that I could not allow that to happen. Because the other thing is that I knew that it's a slippery slope. Once you're able to expel one Black woman because she doesn't fit in socially, she doesn't have the proper social skills, and guess what? The rest of us are about to go too. Because I, for one, was a little bit, well, I've always been a hellraiser. And so, I decided we had to do something. And so part of it was started with the sit-ins in Balch Dorm, and it was Jackie Cox and Muriel Hall, my girlfriends, me dragging them out of their room saying, "You gotta sit down in this hallway, we're having a sit-in." They're like, "What? We're sitting in the hallway because we're having a sit-in." And they came, again, because we were supportive of each other. And the other piece that precipitated it was they were having a white male psychiatrist come in to evaluate this Black girl as to whether or not she was suitable. And I said, "There's no way in the world this white, middle-aged white man is going to be able to evaluate a young inner city Black girl." I mean, we're talking universes apart in terms of understanding, social behavior. And if this is the university standard as to how we are to be judged, how we are to be evaluated, then we got a big problem. We totally have a big problem. That it was Angela Davis who said that Black women have always socialized each other because we've had to. The nature of the greater society was that it did not see Black women as having value, as having urgency, and of existing with rightfulness in this world. And the part of Cornell's experience was that you take all these classes, and I took a course called Myth, Ritual, and Symbol. And in that course, they talked about how education, religion, and psychiatry are tools of control. They're tools to basically say what is normative and what is not normative. And what I realized by Cornell bringing in this white, middle-aged white male psychiatrist to evaluate this young Black girl, that this was control. This was not about helping her in any way. It was about how to exclude any elements that were, shall we say, not pleasing or not fitting in with Cornell's ethos of who they are and how they are. And so that started, you know, really with the demonstrations, with, you know, demand letters. We wrote the administration and so on and so forth. And what I said is that Black women have a right to define themselves, that we are at Cornell and we are not necessarily of Cornell. And that there was a Jewish house, there was a French house, there were, you know, all of these other houses that basically espoused the cultural continuity within their walls. And I felt that Black women needed the same thing in terms of how we are maintaining ourselves mentally and emotionally in a predominantly white environment.
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you so much. I think also one thing that I heard that really resonated with me is when you said we are at Cornell, but we are not of Cornell. And I just wonder, like, how did you kind of come to this understanding of how to be an activist in these spaces when you're surrounded by, you know, it being a predominantly white institution? So I guess, like, what inspired your activism to kind of go into these spaces and change them, instead of just saying, okay, this is terrible, right? And it sucks. But how did you kind of move from recognizing there's a problem to inspiring, you know, what inspired you to kind of take action and do these things and start these organizations and really be an activist on campus?
Well, I think a lot of it, I grew up in Harlem, New York, under segregation. And under segregation, Black people had a counter narrative. And the counter narrative was, we don't care what the rest of those folks say about us. We know we're important. We know we're smart. We know we're capable. And so coming from being steeped in this counter narrative to come to a place where basically I'm supposed to bow down and be grateful, you know, et cetera, just was very inconsistent with the kind of upbringing I had. And, you know, I grew up in Harlem, New York at a time where there was no crime. It was no drugs, the streets were spotless, and a community where everybody was connected with everybody else. And they were generally one generation, if not two generations, removed from the South. And Harlem was a Southern community that just happened to be in the North. And literally any adult could spank you, feed you, clothe you. And that's just what it was. Because the community, the kids belonged to everybody. You know, and we'd be roaming, we'd play hide and seek in people's apartments because nobody locked doors. So it's great to hide in a back closet or whatever. And so again, that was the kind of mental framework that I had. And then I come to a place that says to me, I cannot be myself. And the idea, and it was interesting, I had done a little research in terms of Cornell, and the first Black woman who went to Cornell, I mean, Andrew Dixon White, was very adamant that everybody can come, Black, white, male, female, all races, et cetera, et cetera. So the first Black woman to come, and let me get my notes out here. Here they are, got it. The first Black woman to come to Cornell was a Jane Eleanor Datcher. And she was the first known Black woman. And this is when Cornell was started in the 1890s. You know, and again, in terms of how Black women were housed, it was a mixed bag because there were instances where Black women were allowed in the dorms to live with the other students. And there were instances where Black women were denied, depending on the racism in the 1920s. Like, who was it? President Livingston Farrar, president of Cornell from 1921 to 1937, denied Black women residence at Cornell. And again, it ebbed and it flowed. You know, and it's interesting that Margaret Morgan Lawrence, whose daughter is Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, she went to Cornell and she was a servant for a wealthy white family in Ithaca. So she lived with that family while she went to school. And so it's been a really interesting kind of process of, you know, Black women at Cornell in terms of we're allowed in the dorms, we're not allowed in the dorms. We're servants, you know, and go to school, et cetera. And so the idea of a Black women's residence was very radical at the time in terms of the administration even conceiving of it. They want to do what? You know, but the idea was that we're whole human beings. We have agency. We can make choices, you know, about ourselves in terms of what's best for us. And so the idea that Black women could exist in an environment where other Black women, and again, because we have always socialized each other, and that's where our strength lies. That if we look at, you know, Black women who are just exposed to the greater society, you know, somehow we're less than, we're weaker than. I mean, I look at, Instagram videos, and almost half those videos show these Black women who are horribly disfigured with their hair. I mean, they're half bald. They've got the weaves, they've got the glue-ins, they've got the, you know, but the point is, what's wrong with Black hair? You know, for centuries we've had this hair, but all of a sudden you have a whole group of Black women who are willing to disfigure themselves, because sometimes when you see them before the weaves or before the wigs, it's scary. I mean, they're huge patches of, you know, balding, alopecia, I mean, all these other kinds of things that they've done to themselves to try to approximate, so that when we are in a situation where we only have a white standard of beauty, by their standards, we're always going to come up short. And so it was important that Black women be in an environment where, guess what, everywhere you look, as I said, in Harlem, there were a million Black people who looked like me. I never questioned being brown. I never questioned kinky hair, because everybody around me had kinky hair. But when you're in an environment where everybody else has long, silky hair and they're, you know, pale, et cetera, you begin to evaluate yourself according to those kinds of standards. And so particularly in terms of this, the Black student that they were trying to expel, I felt it was important that we do not have standards that we have to be like them. We can be ourselves. And we have impact and value and importance as ourselves, as Black women.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. I guess, you know, I think you talking about like Black women's hair, and also just like when you see yourself, you realize that it's normal and it's beautiful. I guess it kind of connects a lot to your career and your different jobs you've had over the years, from you being one of the first natural hair models, and also to becoming a children's author, and writing about Black children and Black stories. So I guess, how did you decide to I guess, kind of focus your career within Black children, being a Black children's author, focusing on literacy? How did that become, I guess, the trajectory of your career? And also, I guess, I'm also really interested about how you kind of became a natural hair model too, and the story to that. But I guess just how you kind of got from a natural hair model to a children's author, and just your journey to deciding you wanted to go into these spaces, and how they connected also to your activism at college, right? So you graduated and then you kind of go into all these different spaces that are so connected. But it's kind of how, like, what was your journey and how did you start to focus on those different places and careers?
Well, I wish I could say I had a plan, but I didn't necessarily have a plan. Life happens. And in terms of, you know, I was also Miss Black New York State when I came to Cornell. And so again, that Black is Beautiful, you know, Miss Black America pageant, all these beautiful Black girls from all over the world, all over the United States. You know, everywhere I looked, there were these beautiful, beautiful Black women. And then to come to a space that tells me, oh no, your hair is not good enough. Oh no, your skin, I'm like, no. Oh no to you. You know, I know who I am. And again, I'm coming from that background of Harlem, all that segregated powder narrative pumping me up and selling me that I'm beautiful. And so the natural hair model piece actually happened because I was walking down 125th Street in Harlem, and this man comes up to me and says, oh, you're so pretty, you should be a model. And I said, sure, my mother told me about men like you. Aha, I've heard those stories. I said, give me your car. And he gave me his card. And he turned out to be legitimate, because as you know, there are lots of men who'll say lots of things to get you to go with them. And so I became one of the first natural hair models, along with Richard Roundtree, who was on the male side, for Afro Sheen. And it was just kind of, you know, I just happened to be walking down 125th Street. And this man came up. It's not as if I was auditioning or seeking any of this out. It just sort of presented an opportunity. And I said, well, why not? Let's go for it. And then the idea of the children's books was that actually I had been working in city government in Boston, and I got laid off, and I was reading an article in the paper about Little Brown, and Little Brown was having their 100th anniversary, 100 years of publishing. They didn't have any Black authors. All of the books that were written about Black children were written by white authors. And I said, well, that's not a good thing, you know? The perspective is different. And so I called up the publisher of Little Brown, and I said, I'm an author, and you need to publish my book. And he said, okay. And I was like, what? Okay, because I hadn't written anything. I was just fishing, you know, seeing what's out there, what it'll say. I figured they'll give me the personnel, whatever. I did not expect him to say that he would publish my book, sight unseen. And so after about 6 months of going back and forth, you know, we did publish my first book, Irene and the Big Fine Nickel.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much. I remember, I'm born in 2002. And I remember reading one of your books called Don't Say Ain't. Remember when I was a kid?
Oh, yes.
Yes. So yeah, I definitely appreciate you and all your work. And that's really an amazing story. I guess also in that work of writing books for Black children and also being a Black person writing those stories, I think a big part of that is becoming a role model for so many different Black children, and also within your work throughout your whole career, a lot of it kind of connects to being a role model and being a Black woman in political power and showing Black women, Black girls everywhere it's possible to do that work. So that's one of my questions is, like, did you see any role models in your life that were sources of inspiration for you in making you the woman you are today, that kind of were serving as the same person you are to other people today? I don't know if you see any role models throughout your life.
Well, I had a grandmother who actually had a second grade education. And she always said to me, you know, you don't ever have nothing, child, you always have you. And what she basically was saying was that everything you need in life, you've got. No matter what the outside world sees or thinks or whatever, it's not about the money, it's not about, you know, the fancy dresses or whatever, it's about you and the essence of who you are and what you're capable of. And so I've always remembered that, you know, and particularly when I went to Cornell, I was miserable. Miserable. I wanted to come home. I called, like, crying, and I'm like, I gotta come home. I said, these people are eating cottage cheese. I'd never seen people eat cottage cheese before in my life until I got to Cornell, and they would have big bowls of cottage cheese in the dining hall, and these girls would just get bowls and bowls because they were all watching their weight, bowls and bowls of cottage cheese. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. I can't eat cottage cheese. And my grandmother would listen to me and she'd say, girl, you're going too far to fall back. And I said, but I gotta get out of here. They're feeding me cottage cheese. I mean, this is like the worst. And she'd listen and she'd listen. She never interrupted. And she'd say, girl, you're going too far to fall back. And I'd say some more and, oh, this is terrible. And finally, by the end of it, I'd say, okay, Nana, I've gone too far to fall back. And I go back out and do it again and try again.
That's beautiful. I needed to hear that too, because cottage cheese is not good and they still eat cottage cheese today.
Oh, I mean, unbelievable. But it's great if you're on a diet, you know? It's great if you're watching your weight and so on and so forth. And I was just like astounded because I had never seen that before. And I remember when we were driving up from New York City to Ithaca the first time, and I had my nephew with me, and he said, oh, look at all those big dogs. He was looking, he had never seen a cow in person. And there were these farms. And he says, oh, so many big dogs. And I had to tell him, no, that's not a dog, that's a cow.
Yeah, I know the trip from New York to Ithaca is always like a weird, like, you see all the different farms, and yeah. It's definitely an interesting drive for sure.
Worlds apart. But again, you know, as Black women, you know, we have done so much for this country, so much in terms of our community, that, you know, we can bridge that gap and make it work. And the other thing that's really important is that education is the one thing that has enabled Black people to move ahead in this society. And so even though it's been a, shall we say, not an easy road in terms of education and Black women getting their full benefit of that education, you know, we have to keep striving. That's why children's books are important to me in terms of that early literacy, that we build this, the building blocks, because from kindergarten through second grade, you learn how to read. From third grade on, for the rest of your life, you read to learn. And if children, like we did with COVID was 2 years of kids being out of school. And so those children who should have been getting those building blocks of literacy, 50% is gone. And you almost can never make up for it, because teachers have to keep going. They have a curriculum. So there's no 2 years that they have to set aside to bring these children up to where they go, where they should be academically. And so the fact that we have an opportunity to get an education, Cornell was a good education, is something that we have to take full and complete advantage of.
Right. I definitely agree with that. I guess also with your recent initiative, Literacize, I guess it's also part of your legacy of education and Black empowerment. I guess, like, do you see a link between social activism, education, but also in a link to political leadership?
Most definitely, because the other thing is that when I grew up in Harlem, again, there was no crime, no drugs, you know, nobody locked doors and stuff like that. Black people were healthy. I mean, Black people, there were normal weight, that if I saw a fat Black woman, I could count her on one hand. The number of Black women I'd see who are overweight. Now, 60% of Black women are overweight. That, I mean, over 50% of Black women are having balding hair problems. And I'm saying, I grew up at a time where Black people had less money, you know, less access, but we were healthy and we were striving in every sense of the word. And so the idea that, in some ways, I think segregation was positive for Black people because it enabled us to maintain a counter-narrative about ourselves. But to the extent that the greater society's messages for us as Black women are not supportive, are not educational, are not nurturing, you know, I think that's caused a major problem, you know. And it was so funny, I was talking to a friend of mine, when I grew up, Black people diddy-bop down the street. You know, they sashayed, they did all this stuff. And now I see people on walkers. I see people with amputations. I see, you know, and wait a minute, like, what happened? You know, this, you know, two generations ago, this was a hearty, healthy people. And, you know, the other thing is that in terms of drugs, and again, drugs made the greatest impact in Harlem in terms of transforming the community for the worse, is that when I grew up, when the drugs started to appear, Black drug addicts hid. They were ashamed. You know, and now they're all over the street corners, totally comfortable with themselves. And I'm like, wow, what happened? That this is seen as normative behavior. It's okay, you know, it's not okay. You know, because it's eating at the fabric of our families and our community.
Yeah, thank you for that answer. I guess my next question kind of focuses more so on your leadership within the different organizations that you've had. So I guess, do you feel that there's issues you're better able to address because you are a Black woman? And do you feel like you use a gender lens when you're solving different problems?
Well, I think the nature of being a female is that you're more nurturing. You're more supportive, even though there are some examples of women who are totally hardcore. It just is shall we say, structured and transactional as males, but generally you have that lens, you know, of how can we get the best good for everyone involved? And I'm reading a book right now, The 1619 Project. I mean, in terms of the stories they talked about Black women having no rights to their bodies, no rights to their children, no rights in terms of, you know, sexual advances by any man, you know, are just okay because we don't have value. And, you know, reading and listening to all of those stories, it just sort of, whew, we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. And so the activism comes from, again, from segregation, from a family that was not well educated, didn't have the opportunity. I mean, I'm growing up, our mailman had a PhD in physics. He couldn't get a job. The best job he could get was delivering mail. And so knowing all of those stories and having experienced all of those people, you recognize how important education is and how important, and you have to push, because we have not gotten anywhere without pushing, without being aggressive, without saying, you know, we matter. And this is what we want. You know, I remember when one of the administrators at Cornell called me irascible. I didn't even know what irascible meant at the time, but I was like, yes, I'm irascible. You know, in terms of I had to be fierce and I had to keep coming because I felt that there was so much at stake.
That's definitely really, really powerful to hear. I guess just considering what it means to be a Black woman in those roles and being an activist and being so visible to people. I know we've studied in our class that Black women get, I guess, scrutinized so much more heavily on, you know, how competent they are, what they look like, what they're wearing. Are they like rude or are just like these ideas that don't really apply in any way to their actual leadership? I guess, you know, you talked about that, you know, they called you irascible. I guess, have you experienced that also in your leadership positions? And I guess, how have you dealt with that, I guess, with the differential treatment of Black women leaders?
Well, you got to ignore it. You know, you have a goal and you head for the goal. And, you know, you make coalitions if you can, you seek allies if you can, but if you can't, then you just keep pushing. And the idea is that Black people, I mean, you think about the Great Migration, about Black people coming from the South with nothing, you know, pretty much their children and what meager belong, and just starting a new life in New York, Chicago, you know, in the major cities. I mean, that took, wow, that took a lot. You think about Black women who were on slave ships, who literally for 6 months, you know, were cramped in, you know, I mean, you think about that kind of courage, you know, and so the kind of stuff that I'm doing, well, it's okay, you know, but I'm not facing, you know, no one's has a noose around my neck and no one's going to lynch me or, you know, hopefully not, but, you know, all of these kinds of things. And so you recognize, you know, the sacrifices that have made in the that have been made in the past in your name. And again, in your name, in my name. I mean, these were nameless Black women who we may never know the names, but they pushed and they sacrificed so their children could do better. And so I kind of keep that kind of mantra in my mind when I'm approaching a dilemma or a problem. I'm saying, okay, you know, we made it past the slave ship, we made it past Jim Crow, and, you know, we're still having to fight a lot of the same battles. But one of the things that I'm really, really encouraged with is I'm seeing a number of young white people and older white people who were, you know, when George Floyd, you know, was murdered, they hit the streets and they stayed in the streets. And I was like, oh, this is a flash in the pan. They didn't. They pushed and they pushed. And I was like, wow. This whole concept of a universal struggle and how the things that impacts Black people, impacts us all, is beginning to get there. So I've been, you know, really encouraged lately.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I guess also hearing that, and I definitely agree, like there's so many Black women who've come before us that have done so much work and we'll never know their names because, yeah, and that really hits me. I know when I am doing work, and whether I think it's so hard, I know that there's someone behind me who did so much more, and I owe it to them to keep pushing and keep, you know, struggling, and do as best as I can. So I definitely resonate with that a lot. I guess also in hearing that, I think that Black women have done so much work and we've been responsible for so much progress in our communities. But at the same time, we kind of also fail to focus on how we're uplifting ourselves and kind of put ourselves by the wayward to support other people. I read that you're also the president of the Cornell Black Alumni Association and the founder of that as well.
Right. Because one of the things that half of the people, I was in a class of 71, and half of the people, the Black students that went to Cornell that were in my class, did not graduate on time. That the straight, the whole Black struggle was such a, we paid such a high price emotionally and psychologically, because people were in it to, I mean, no matter what, we're willing to put our lives on the line, we're willing to put our careers on the line, we were putting our futures on the line, we were in it all the way. And I graduated from Cornell, and it was like, wow, is that it? I mean, I just literally offered to die, and that's it? Give me a piece of paper and I walk away. And I thought about the half that didn't graduate. You know, I was one of the lucky ones. I don't know how I did that, but anyway, we won't go there. Spend more time active being an activist than I did studying. But the idea, and so I guess I felt that I was tied to those people in a way. It's tie that binds. It's called a crucible. We've been through a crucible. We have been tested by fire. And then you walk away. And it's like, wait a minute, what happened? You know, we were in this fiery pit and we were all together. And so that's really why I started the Cornell Black Alumni Association, to keep those ties recognized, to recognize the ties were there, to understand how important and impactful our experience had been at Cornell. You know, the classes of 70, 71, 72, you know, 69, I mean, the whole thing. I mean, there were like a four-year period of folks who were just tested by fire. And we were all going to different parts of the United States. We were all going different, but wait a minute. You know, what is it? I always say Cornell, I spent 10 years there one night because it was that intense. It was that soul-wrenching. The whole experience of the straight, of the sit-ins, of the, you know, the burning down of the Black Student Union. I mean, all of those things that we were going through, the burning of a cross, you know, I mean, all of that, we were going through that collectively, emotionally. And so I felt with the Cornell Black Alumni Association, we had to recognize and give space and honor to that experience, to what we had experienced together. And, you know, to have a place of a containment where we can be with others who've experienced it, heal, and then go our separate ways. I mean, we were traumatized. You understand, we're 18, 19 years old, shall we say. We're not the most, you know, sophisticated people in the world. And we were going through that trauma together. And so, again, I wanted to acknowledge, you know, really the sacrifice, the emotional and physical, mental sacrifices we made to kind of hold it together, to stay together, to fight toward the goals.
I really appreciate hearing that story. I know that one thing that we talk about often in a lot of my Africana studies classes is that we have this vision of these huge events that happen in history and in time. And I know we learn about the World Trade Takeover and we learn about it in terms of, yeah, this one thing happens, but we don't acknowledge the fact that there's an entire story of lives and people that happened around. So I think that's a really important thing to hear and understand, I guess, like your experience. And I really am grateful for hearing that story. So thank you for all your work you did with that. I guess a question that I have then is just, I guess, like within activism at colleges in general, I think administration has this kind of vision where it's like, oh, we'll be gone in 4 years, you know, we don't have to worry about it. So I guess, like, what advice do you have to, I guess, students who are also activists and are interested in pursuing changes at the university and just activism in general while having to deal with that, like, that time frame that I need to do this in 4 years?
Right. Well, the idea is the alumni associations that run for the boards of these colleges, that you have a say in, you know, how the administration makes certain policies and so on and so forth. And also in terms of fundraising, being supportive, you know, that have on-campus events so you maintain visibility, they can't kind of ignore you. All of those things, you know, integrate in the community, but also know what your agenda is, what your purpose is, and the value that you bring to the table.
Yeah, thank you. I just have one more question. My last question is, what advice would you give to yourself? I guess like from you today, what advice would you give to yourself from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, or what advice would you give to yourself when you're in college, or just any advice you think would be helpful for you to hear from to your younger self?
I think the most important thing is like to trust your instincts, trust your gut. And, you know, the world is good and it's bad and it's indifferent all at the same time. And so being able to kind of discern what's really going on is important. And also always have your anchors, you know, always have those people in your life who, no matter what, whether it's good, bad, they're going to tell you the truth and they're going to steer you in the right direction. So I think the most important thing, if I had, if I knew then what I know now, I would have said, you know, follow your instincts, believe in your gut, stick close to these people who really love you without condition. They're not going to, my grandmother always said, she said, I won't uphold you if you're wrong, but I love you anyway. You know, so whether I was wrong or right, she loved me anyway, but she was going to tell me when I was wrong. So we need to not to get away from those roots. We need not to get away from the people that really help us to thrive and to succeed, you know. And we have to, again, pick up new skills. We have to be sensitive to what's happening, to technology. As I said, social media is like, what? You know, the social media thing is like a phenomenon that I am working to overcome and learn at this stage in my life. But, you know, we have to be on top of that kind of stuff. And we also have to really work with our children. That I see so many programs that work on, you know, Black issues that don't address the issue of children. That we look at healthcare. We look at, this one gentleman told me, I'll never forget that. He said, if we paid attention to brain science, we could eliminate half of an achievement gap in the Black community in terms of how the body best learns. That Lyricize was about the fact that the heart is the part that makes you smart, you know, and that the movement is integral to learning. And so 25% of the blood flow from every heartbeat goes to the brain. And so if we're having children sitting for 4 to 6 hours a day in a classroom, reduces their ability to learn. You know, that if we look at, let's say, the African-American Black community is, shall we say, known for sleep deprivation. Sleep impacts academic achievement, impacts health. I mean, there's science out there that we can use that we're smart enough to be able to find and to use in terms of developing programs that are not just based on what other people tell us to do, but based on what science tells us to do and what our heart tells us to do in terms of addressing the needs of our community and ourselves. You know, that I've been a size 8 for 40 years, you know, and my sisters have gone up and down and up and down, but I've been the same size because I exercise. You know, and I exercise when at Cornell, and to this day, I exercise a minimum of 3 times a week. I mean, there's certain kind of basic things that we can do, that we can teach our children, that will make the major difference in their life. With idea of sleep deprivation, you can add 5 years to your life by getting the adequate amount of sleep each night. That if we know these things, then why aren't we doing these things? Why aren't we implementing these things? We don't need a government program. We don't need someone else, Patrick Monahan, to write a, shall we say, racist report about Black women. I mean, the things he said about Black women were just horrible. You know, and he was lauded, and they have a whole new train station named after him and so on and so forth. But we have to define ourselves. That when we look at, again, Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's mother, she wrote a number of pieces on Black education, Black children, Black psyche, that we look at, Jewel Lattimore. I mean, they're, you know, tomorrow's tomorrow. Black sociologists and psychologists who write about Black women. I mean, it's not as if we have to reinvent the wheel. The information is there. What we have to do is synthesize it in an effective pattern, an effective way, so we can maximize the growth and viability of our community.
Thank you so much for saying that. I definitely really appreciate hearing that. I didn't know all that information about sleep and its impact on you. And that's definitely important to hear for college students who are very sleep deprived. So I
know, very sleep deprived. But actually, the worst thing you can do in terms of performance the next day is to fight not getting enough sleep. So you want to get yourself a good night's sleep. I mean, the research is irrefutable. And the thing is that the lack of sleep leads to diabetes, hypertension, obesity. And these are issues that are endemic among Black community. You know, you think, oh, wait a minute. You know, these are our major health issues and, oh, they're related to lack of sleep. So we've got to really think about it. And the other thing I'd say is that I am not exactly 22 anymore. I was 22 at one point. But, you know, I remember reading an article by Lena Horne in Ebony. And Lena Horne said that when she was 25, she started getting ready for 50. And I was like, well, wait a minute, I'm 25. So I need to start getting ready for 50. But she talked about the kind of healthful habits, the kinds of things that she did to keep her body healthy and strong. Because she knew 50 was coming, and just the nature of life, you know, we don't have the same vitality, the same recuperative powers at 25, at 50 that we had at 25. And I always thought that was so important that we begin to teach young Black girls by taking care of their skin, taking care of their hair, taking care of their, you know, again, overall cardiovascular health and sleep and all these other kinds of things that don't cost money, but make major impacts in their longevity, in their quality of life.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. And where can anyone find resources about literacize that, you know, are sick about education and literacy and exercise in general?
Right. Well, as I said, I'm working on redoing the website. I pulled it down because I wanted to update it because I tried to keep up with the research, you know, but I've also put a Good Night Baby, Black Baby book series called Night Baby Night. So anyone who's interested can go to www.nightbabynight, N-I-T-E, baby, B-A-B-Y, night.com. And it has to do with affirmations. And one thing that's important is that we affirm ourselves. That we start our day with affirmations, that we end our day with sleep affirmations. And so we develop the emotional muscle and the psychic muscle to deal with all the microaggressions, because as you well know, there are lots of microaggressions that Black people are subject to that, you know, begin to wear you down, begin to diminish your sense of self and your sense of value. They had a case on the news of this young Black girl who was being bullied. And these girls were literally just, you know, social media and bullying her in the hall. And one of her texts was, I know I'm ashamed of being Black. And my heart broke. I was like, how is this baby going to be ashamed of being Black? That these people have broken her down to that experience. And so the idea is that we have the tools, we have the knowledge, and we can succeed.
Well, thank you so much. Miss Irene, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been amazing speaking with you and learning all of these nuggets of wisdom. I'm never going to forget this discussion with you. And I'm really grateful for everything you've done to support Black women at Cornell, Black women everywhere, Black children everywhere. I'm just grateful for all the work that you do. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure. And as I said, I'm just so proud of you. You know, I mean, you're absolutely beautiful, and to see Warrior House thriving and have young Black women who understand, you know, the importance and how necessary Warrior House is, that is just so thrilling to me.
Yeah. And
so thank you.
Thank you so much. It would not be possible without you. So we all definitely really are grateful for you and everything you do for Warrior House and continue to do for the world.
Well, thank you. You're very welcome.
And that's the show. Thank you so much for listening. Before I close, I want to give another thank you to Miss Irene Smalls for the time she spent speaking with me and for all the work she has done and continues to do for the world. Also, a quick shout out to Hermela Antenna for all the work she did in helping me to set up this interview. You are very appreciated. If you want to learn more about Miss Irene Smalls and her Literacize initiative, check out www.nightbabynight.com. Again, that's www.nightbabynight.com. My name is Sam, and this has been the In Her Own Words podcast. Take care, y'all.